We're going to expand that theme to India in specific, and more generally, the idea of new models of economic development, Asian models of economic development, their effect on the countries involved, and their effects on the world economy. The official title of this session, I believe, is Asian Models for Global Economic Dominance, which gives a little bit of edge and sass to the topic. And there are any number of fascinating questions I think will be in the background of our discussion today, and we'll try to bring them into the foreground. For example, we often talk of a Chinese model of economic growth. In fact, is there a Chinese model, or are there just circumstances that happen to apply to China right now and that are unique because there's no other country like China? If there is indeed a Chinese model or an Asian model or an India model, is that model sustainable, or is it likely to blow up? And if we look back in a few years, we'll say, well, that was not really a path for anybody to follow. Is there anything particularly Asian about the models we are talking about? India happens to be in South Asia, China in East Asia. There are other countries in that region, but is it Asian in any significant sense, or is it just a contemporary? Is there an Indian model of economic development, or just circumstances that happen to apply in India now? Indeed, does it make any sense at all to compare India and China, to think of them in the same breath? My wife and I recently went to India after spending nearly a year in China, and our main impression was the only thing in common between the two countries was that they were big. Otherwise, it was very hard to say that they were similar in any other way. What will these models mean for the balance of the world economic system? Can they be absorbed? What will they mean for the environment? What will they mean for dominance, as is the title of our talk? And what also, and crucially, will they mean for democracy? It's quite frequent to find in American discussions of the India v. China race a subtle rooting for India so as to validate the idea that a democratically elected national government can perform better in the long run than the heirs of Chairman Mao. To discuss these issues and others, we have the best possible panel of people to hear from. We're going to hear first from Swaminathan Iyer, who's now at the Cato Institute, longtime correspondent for The Economist magazine, consultant to the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank, and he is deeply knowledgeable about what is happening in India and how it fits into this larger pattern. He will be followed by Min-Chin Pei, from the Carnegie Endowment, who you've heard at several other sessions, including I've been involved in myself, who has been one of the experts right now on what is happening in China, what's strong, what's weak, how it fits into world models, where its tensions might lie. And finally, to put it all into the proper balanced perspective, we'll have Kevin Nealer of the Scowcroft Group, former diplomat, trade attorney, well-versed in affairs, global, American, Chinese, and economic. So we're going to have relatively brief opening comments from each of our three panelists, and then the discussion will begin. We'll have plenty of time at the end for questions from you. Please.
Okay. As far as I am concerned, there's no question of anybody aiming for dominance. Everybody will try to get ahead in this particular race of where they are right now. The more they attempt to get ahead, they will only get into interdependence. You are not going to get into dominance. The Tata group of companies made the largest foreign acquisition for a very long time of Anglo-Dutch company called Corus, $13 billion takeover. And earlier we used to be worried about Coca colonialism, and people said, now we will have Tata colonialism. The Indians are going to recolonize Britain. And I said, this is complete rubbish. This is interdependence. This is not a model of dominance. Corus will get at least as much out of it as Tata because it was a friendly takeover, unlike British colonialism.
To understand. Yeah.
Okay. The India-China thing, to use the American sports phrase, it's like comparing the Lakers with the Dallas Cowboys. They're two different games, They're both doing quite well, but the comparison often goes wrong. India is streets behind China in terms of GDP and most other indicators, only one-third the size. The only reason India is suddenly being taken notice of is that while China clearly became number one in mass manufacturing, becomes the world's factory, India suddenly, out of the blue, came up in services. Not only did it come up in services, but then, it's first supposed to be computer software, all kinds of other business services, suddenly it appears can go to a place like India. Now, the interesting thing is this. While original Asian model, if at all there was an Asian model, was labor-intensive manufacturing, which could be done almost by anybody, and lots of cheap labor can keep coming in. As one country goes up, another takes its place. Skills is a very different kind of thing. There's an army, reserve army of cheap labor to take over manufacturing. There is no reserve army of skilled people to take over the globalization of services. So that makes it very, very different. I would add that a huge advantage that India has in this particular respect over China. I mean, China is trying to get into its service areas too. But when the British came, they conquered the whole of India. In China, they stopped at Hong Kong. This therefore means that in India, the ability to speak the English language is far, far more widespread and has been sustained. I was once asked to do an article for a Chinese magazine, and they said 18 pages. I said, isn't that too long? They said, when we translate it into Chinese, it will shrink to 8 pages. I said, this means the two languages are so completely different that no matter how hard they try, the Chinese are going to have a really tough job conquering this English language. So this is an advantage, I think, that will continue for some time. And when you see that the GDP of the world is moving away from industry and manufacturers to services, the global share of services is 60%. In advanced countries, it's 75%. Even sub-Saharan Africa, services are now 47%. So it, in some sense, the only advantage India has is that, okay, it's far behind China, but services is where you want to go in the future, and maybe 20, 30 years from now, that does make a difference. Okay, is there any Indian strategy? India is a messy democracy, and messy democracies are terrible at strategy. The moment one political party says, this is my strategy, the other party will either say you're wrong or you haven't gone far enough. So, I mean, we've in this democracy, we've had 1,000 long speeches, 1,000 strategy papers, 1,000 resolutions, verbiage. There was a time when we had the socialist model with one party in power for 30 years. Lots of noble strategies all failed. So how then does India take off? How is it doing well? The answer is that in the 1990s, we deregulated industry. We reformed the financial sector so that capital became available to all kinds of new guys. And infrastructure came in for global connectivity. When this happened, all sorts of new entrepreneurs were suddenly able to start businesses and new sectors that no strategist or planner had ever thought of. I mean, India's software industry, for instance, was never planned. I mean, in fact, if at all there was an Indian strategy, it was we must not allow labor to be displaced by computers. So if you have a country without computers, how do you get computer skills? And the truth is that the Indian software industry was made in Silicon Valley. And then those guys came back, that's how the skills came. Apart from the services, the brain-intensive manufacturing is rising. In mass manufacturing, our trade unions and politicians will make quite sure that our labor laws are so bad that we can never do mass manufacturing. So no competition to China. On the other hand, you'll find that these same guys, for instance, opposed very strongly the WTO arrangements on intellectual property rights. So the Indian strategy was we must not allow it. The WTO agreement forced India to come into it. That strategic failure was the beginning of Indian success of the pharmaceutical industry. So the Indian pharmaceutical industry has now taken off, whether it's clinical trials, it's become a research hub, active ingredient contract. So you know, in a series of things, the brain-intensive manufacturing, again, if you go back to the mid-1990s, no planner had envisaged these new areas where India is going to take off. That you know, will become provider of legal services. And you even have things like Moody's and Standard & Poor's who have reluctantly finally increased India to investment grade. And yet the fact is, both of them are rapidly shifting all their staff to India to do that very analysis. So, okay, India is well set on this, but basically India is a failure of strategy. India is an example of non-strategy, allowing 1,000 players to develop new ideas and conquer markets that were never thought of. The big skill shortage coming up, as I mentioned earlier, a huge challenge for the future. China and many other countries are much better than India in social development. That remains a huge challenge. Finally, I think we have to add that while there is a world-class India, which looks very impressive, this is only 1% of the population. 1% of the Indian population is 11 million people, which is a hell of a lot of people, and they are the kind of people you will meet if you go to India. The still question of what about the other 99%? There's a huge amount of work to be done. But I think, you know, the towns are taking off. If you got the global connectivity plus education, we took off in the towns. If every Indian village can be given that global connectivity plus education, I think they too can take off.
Great. Thank you very much. Before moving on, I have to note with admiration the bi-national, almost bilingual cultural illusion that Swaminathan just made, which is talking on the one hand about the Lakers versus the Cowboys, and, you know, cementing yourself with the American part of the audience. On the other hand, using a phrase that no one can ever utter convincingly in an American accent, which is complete rubbish or utter rubbish. So I admire that you're working both sides of the English language there. Please, Min Chan Pei. Yes.
Thanks. I would say that if you look at post-World War II economic development history, there's no question that East Asian countries, Japan, North Korea, Taiwan, Singapore, and now China, have done better than any other developing countries in the world. So what are the ingredients for success? So the so-called East Asian model. It's a controversial concept, but there are four elements that are present in their economic success. The first one is that all of these countries had and still have high savings rate. And if you have high savings rate, you basically have got the most important ingredient for rapid economic growth because you can invest. And if you again look at these countries, high takeoff period has been accompanied by very high sustained investments. So that's number one. Number two is that these countries rejected economic isolation. They've embraced globalization when the term became popular. They all pursued a strategy of integration with the global economy. Here, there are controversies. Was this two schools of thought? One believed that East Asians pursued a mercantilist strategy, that is, taking advantage of the free trading system of the world while protecting their domestic industry at the same time. The other does not believe that was the case. I tend to believe the second, because if you look at the record carefully, you'll find the most successful industries in East Asia tend to be those that are least or less protected. And I really like Jim's cover piece in The Atlantic, because the industry he described was the least protected industry. The most successful industries in China are not owned by the Chinese government. They are foreign-owned and private sector-owned. So this is the second ingredient. The third ingredient is responsible macroeconomic policy. These countries did not experience frequent episodes of high inflation. They managed their tax policies relatively well. And this one element, which is again controversial, is that they all maintained undervalued exchange rate for a long time, Japan, South Korea, and on China. That ensured economic stability. And finally, they all invested heavily in education and health. If you look at human development index of these countries, they are all above the countries at a comparable level of economic income. So these four ingredients are now so self-evident, but it's very hard to do. That's why only East Asian countries have. But East Asian countries are now experiencing enormous difficulty in moving up the value chain because they are not good at doing three things. The first one is innovation. They are late developers. They are very good at copying ideas, technologies. So they are very good at manufacturing things that have already been manufactured in other countries, simply moving to Asia, reducing the cost of their competitors. They are not really good at developing their own technology and indigenous capability, even though they are not doing better than before. I think Japan is doing better than the rest of East Asia. The second problem is that they are really poor at branding. Think of international brands coming out of Asia. You can practically count all the Asian brands are two hands. Japan probably has seven, and South Korea has three, and China has none. Taiwan has none. Singapore has none. That's the biggest, because branding takes unique skills. And today, you make most of your money by brands, through brands. You don't want to do the tough assembly manufacturing. Another, again, I recommend Jim's piece in The Atlantic. And finally, Asia may have very modern, efficient factories. They do not have efficient institutions. And I'll give you some examples. Asian financial institutions, financial markets, regulatory regimes are way, way behind the Western counterparts. Of course, in East Asia, countries or regions differ. Hong Kong probably has the best, but Japan is way behind, and China isn't even way, way behind. Second is that they do not have great universities. In America, they have great universities, and great universities produce good talents. And finally, East Asian countries cannot attract global talents. And that, if you want to move up the value chain, if you can't do any of these three things, you have a limit. So I would say at the end of the day, Asia has done well and will continue to do well, but they're nowhere close to dominating the global economy.
So this is very interesting. We have, from our first speaker, a description of success despite strategy, despite the absence of strategy. We have now a description of a strategy successful only up to a certain point, but then hitting its limits. Kevin Kneeler, how should we think about this altogether?
I think those points of view are all true, but it's not that good. The ultimate book on the ultimate report or analysis on the Asian economic miracle came out with the exquisite timing of the World Bank in January of 1997. If that number has a ring to you, I guarantee it resonates loudly in Asia. The model was there, but as our other speaker suggested, it's a brittle model. Let me, on the theory that any conversation with Americans becomes a conversation about Americans, let me just start out by saying briefly, when I left government in 1987, in the intervening 20 years, not once has anybody in the risk analysis space or any of the American clients that we have, not once has anyone ever posed to me the question, should we go with China or go with India? I know that's the mythic subject of a lot of magazine articles, not Jim's. But in the real world of business, that isn't the question. Asia, you may have noticed, is a rather large place. And it's dominated by the world's second largest economy, which Minchin mentioned. But we get through a lot of these discussions without regard to Japan. They're still there. They're doing fine, thank you, and they're doing better every day. And American businesses, European and Japanese businesses even, tend to talk about these economies and direct investment choices in terms of an Asia strategy and in terms of pieces of Asia strategy. The notion that it's a zero-sum game for inward investment in India or China is just flat wrong. In terms of how each of them see their role internationally, I was struck by what Swami said about sort of the infancy of these ideas. We're 10 plus years away from the end of the Cold War. Has anyone in the last 4 or 5 days, including Colin Powell, told you what the American paradigm for U.S. foreign policy is, absent the organizing principle of the Cold War? We don't have one. So how can you be surprised that neither the Chinese nor the Indians have arrived at one? It's really only in the last 5 years that these countries have the economic confidence to begin to think about themselves in the international space. This is very ungenerous, but I would submit that neither China nor India, in much of the 50 years after World War II, had what passes as a foreign policy. They had a concentration on border issues and how they protect their borders, and that was very biopic as between China and India. But they're largely over that, and they're just beginning to look at the region, at Near Asia, in a way that's more programmatic. You know, has it been your experience that governments are very good at that kind of proactive behavior? It's not mine. You can find books written by think tanks in both countries posing thesis about how they should behave in the region. But to sum up, I think what gives me a lot of the place I look for a lot of insight is the internal incentive structures in systems. I look at what goes on. I think weeks, nay, months go by in the State Council or in the cabinet in India without anyone talking about the United States in particular, but anyone obsessing about foreign policy, because the incentive structure for those leaderships is about what? It's about delivering locally. The measure of success is the improvement of life locally. And incidentally, if you're looking at foreign policy objectives, it's to do what? It's to secure access to commodities. Now, this brings me to my very last point, which is the neuralgia that the U.S. is currently feeling, and I think justifiably, with China in particular and its acquisition of energy resources. Both India and China have come to the energy market, the blue light special, if you will, just about 20 years too late. And it's just a big bucket of oil after all. Forget the romance. They really don't care where you're from. You come in, you know, Brent Sweet crude is the same for you, me, and the other guy. The Chinese have pursued an aggressive strategy, obviously, of direct investment, trying to own wellheads and production. It's butted heads with U.S. interests in places like Sudan and Nigeria. We've also seen China begin to act to distort foreign policy interests, global foreign policy interests in the development field, where they show up, as they did famously in Angola, basically blowing up the World Bank's program with loans that were tied to nothing other than a smile and a handshake, no real developmental goals. I think we can reliably imagine that that's going to continue to be a problem. The U.S. policy with coping with that isn't there yet. We've got a rhetorical policy, but sitting down with Chinese officials and kind of working through where the interests are and where they diverge, we're not there yet. The one other very last notion is we've seen this episodic approach, less by India but more with China, to free trade agreements. To be clear, almost none of these meet the smell test of no kidding free trade agreements. They're preferential investment deals that China makes with others, principally in Asia. I call it the eat me last approach to trade policy. You know, we'll deal with the Chinese on a special basis, all in the hope that they eat us last. Those deals chafe both in terms of U.S. interests in region, India's interests in the region, and with China's WTO obligations. Bob Hormats, who some of you just saw, and I wrote a book about China's WTO accession, which now looks slightly comical. But no kidding, to the extent that you divert energy on bilateral one-off deals, you're cheapening the amount of emphasis you can give to pushing barriers down everywhere in the multilateral system. And I'm not a WTO theologist. I'm of the Deng Xiaoping view. I don't care about the package, if the cat is black or white, as long as it catches mice. However free trade is delivered, I'll take it. But you'll notice last week, almost without notice in the American newspapers, the Doha round just sort of kind of died. And it didn't seem to be with any economic penalty. Certainly the financial markets were generally up on that news. But I think it's bad news for both India and China. And I think conspicuously China has contributed to undermining the international system in that regard. It's something they've got to course correct on. It's something where we're looking for a more mature view to emerge. And I don't say that as a purely U.S.-centric view. I think it's the expectations of others in the region. So look for more friction points there.
Thank you all very much. Were you attached here? Oh, yes. Thank you. Let me start with a couple of journalist-type questions of making sure we're all understanding clearly a message that I think runs through all of your comments and in some sense has been omitted from all of your comments. There are two implicit surprises for me in what you all in one way or another are saying. One is, it seems to me, one way or another, all of you are saying the basic premise of this session, the model for global economic dominance, is just wrong. That you're talking about phenomena in very large countries that are limited in certain ways, and this is not a new model of economic growth and development, nor are we talking about new dominant powers. Is that so, say you all? And that, which is interesting and different from the tone of much U.S. discourse. Second, it struck me that all of you were saying explicitly or implicitly that it's crazy to talk about China and India together, as we so often do in American discourse. Is that true, or does that overstate the point?
I think to the extent that these are two large countries which can absorb a lot of foreign investment, it makes sense for any foreign investor to put them together for that reason. It also makes sense to the extent that since they have different specializations, there's a diversified portfolio. Beyond that, I do think it is a mistake.
And so say you all or not?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I think the only, as Swami said, though, from when you talk to U.S. policymakers, Jim, you know well, they're going to default into thinking about the fastest growing economy and the second fastest growing economy together, and in ways that the business community just thinks is crazy, they're going to insist on analogies and disanalogies.
But my inference or my argument here is that perhaps those of you in the position to steer how policy leaders think could urge them in a different direction, or at least that would be the implication of what we're saying here. You're saying that is so hardwired into them that that's how they're going to be and how we in the press will be too.
I think that's an ambitious goal and one that the Ideas Fest is all about.
Well, boys be ambitious, as they used to say in Hokkaido. That was one of the mottos there. I'd like to explore a point that Min-Chin Pei made about some of the barriers to the model of East Asian development as they apply in East Asia, as they have some counterparts in India, and as they have meaning for the United States. Two of them were particularly important, struck me in particular, were the weakness of the university system and the difficulty of many East Asian societies as talent destinations. This was dramatically clear to me, the latter, when I was living in Japan, where the burden of being non-Japanese is omnipresent and inescapable. It strikes me as a much lighter burden in China, where China is much more accepting of foreigners. I think the attitude towards language is different. In Japan, the attitude is, if you speak Japanese, somehow that's against nature, whereas in China, the attitude is, why aren't you speaking Mandarin? And so is it inconceivable? And I see the China that I see is full of foreigners studying Mandarin. So would you elaborate a little more on this barrier of China as a talent destination when at the moment it seems to be full of talent, full of foreign talent?
Only up to a point, as China among East Asian societies is relatively open. That's because China was so thoroughly humiliated at the hands of the Westerners. So this superiority complex turned into the inferiority complex, and that lowered the barriers. But today, there are, despite the embracing of foreign talent, there are deep psychological barriers. If you look at how non-Americans, people like me, have done at the very top of American academic, government, economic establishments. You just don't find any equivalent chance. China may be moving in the right direction, but it's so way behind, so behind that it will be a long time. And then talk about political barrier, because China, after all, is an authoritarian state. And the idea of having non-Chinese, non-Communist Party members, people who were brought up in a very different cultural environment with very different political values into decision-making bodies is very, very, very alien to China. So I think even for China, and that the bureaucratic, the assimilation, the difficulty to assimilate foreign talent has a lot to do with this hierarchical culture that dominates Asia. I think Westerners would find it very difficult to deal with, even for a transplanted Asian. I mean, I've been living in the States for 23 years. Once I attended a conference in Singapore, when the Minister of Justice from Indonesia entered the room, they asked to stand to greet him. I said, what a ridiculous thing to do. Because it's, and when Lee Kuan Yew walked in the room, they played some ridiculous music to greet him. Because it's, of course, this is trivial, but then day in, day out, you've got to follow protocol. You have to, that limits discussion. That, and for very talented people, they really do not take hierarchy seriously.
And Sonny, would you comment on this from the Indian perspective? Is there a chance of India becoming a talent destination, and also the existing excellence of Indian universities, how can that be expanded? Is it a limit or a plus for India?
As Indian universities are not excellent. There is a small number of decent ones, a huge number of so-so and half god-awful. Because
complete rubbish, you might say.
Precisely because the government educational system is so bad, private institutions of every kind are sprouting. Every kind of skill, from a cruise ship hospitality to pilot to ordinary software stuff. Same story there. They're probably 25% are usable, 75% are non-usable. But what is now therefore what is happening is a large number of companies will hire guys and then put them through a 6-month or 9-month course. In effect, the big corporations are becoming the new universities. But there is a huge skills problem. It is being tackled very poorly by the government. There is this private sector alternative coming up. However, the private sector alternative can deal with the tertiary sector education. Basic education will still have to be done by the government. That remains a problem. As for a magnet for foreigners, two parts. One is the universities, one is the companies. As far as the companies are concerned, it has become much easier. The attitudes of suspicion of the foreigner, the barriers have gone down a lot. The ultimate was, I think, when the Indian cricket team got a foreign coach. That certainly showed a huge change in just cultural attitudes. The real barrier used to be salaries. I mean, in India, until 1991, the government had a salary of 15,000 rupees a month for any director of a company, which at that time would have been, I don't know, a couple of $1,000. So, you know, with the globalization of Indian companies, there's full realization that we have to have a large number of guys coming in. And in India, many of them, I think, seem to feel more at home than they would in other parts of East Asia. So that is a plus point. On the universities, I regret to say the government has this continuing huge suspicion of foreign academics. There's a huge discouragement of foreigners to study in India. That is a definite minus point.
And Kevin, I'd like to turn to you in your role as expert on how American politicians think. This is your role here, which is implicitly you've heard that two great advantages the U.S. has are its university system and its talent destination role in the entire world. Are these appreciated in the American political system now, do you think, and will we continue to shore these up as bulwarks?
Jim, I think a lot of the hand-wringing we have about globalization that we've heard a lot about in the last couple of days comes from the embedded belief that this is the worst educational system in the world. We're going to hear more about that this afternoon. The number that you get all the time in Washington, of course, is the number of engineers that both of these countries create. But it's really important to listen to what's just been said. Mitchell will tell you that while I was sitting with a U.S. government agency, not the Agriculture Department, a couple weeks back, as they were wringing their hands about the number of Chinese engineers, this is the same week that Duke University issued a report based on what the Jiawei, the State Education Commission, had done in China, saying that a third of the engineers that are being produced by Chinese universities are not only currently unemployed, but are unemployable because they don't have world-class skill sets. So right-sizing U.S. competitiveness in these areas, in our own minds, in our own policy equation, is something I don't think we've taken account of yet.
Just to add my own observation here, I mentioned in a couple times in Atlantic articles I've done from China, the most personally impressive cadre of people I've found in China, I think also the most valuable, both to China and the United States, are the Chinese natives who've spent, 5 to 8 to 15 years in the United States and come back. You know, they have been, in a sense, they've been trained in a very different way from they would have been in China, and they've been implicitly Americanized in a good sense, in a way that I think is good for China and also tremendously good for the United States. So the first point on my action plan for U.S.-China relationships is to maximize the supply of these people, keep them bringing into American graduate schools and corporations, then eventually back to China. Let me ask both of our spokesmen for the two great Asian powers about how Americans should think about one aspect of the respective rises of India and China. I mentioned this earlier. There is an implied sense in a lot of discussion of these two countries that if China, quote, wins, unquote, the ideal of democracy has lost, and India's success or failure also is as an avatar, you might say, for the values of democracy. How should Americans think of this issue, the connection between democratic ideals worldwide and the success of these two countries?
Okay, this actually started back in the 1950s. Cold War times, India and China were the two guys coming up, and the theory was that all the third world countries are becoming independent and all of them are looking to China and India to decide which way to go. Complete rubbish. Every one of them went their own way. And in fact, politics is not only in America but everywhere is intensely local. It was in tribe versus tribe, region versus region, cool leader versus civilian. These things dominated the way you go. So nobody is just going to be looking to China versus India and seeing which way to go. The democracy versus other thing will be intensely decided by local institutional changes. Going beyond that, there are advantages in both models and everybody can see it. You can see that if you have an authoritarian state, it is capable of very forcefully, in a totalitarian way, implementing a vision. This could lead to huge success and huge disaster. A democracy, on the other hand, has this situation where everybody is saying the other guy is wrong and saying so openly. So it's a messy thing. It means that you will perhaps never do as well as the best autocracy, but you will never do as badly as the worst. So, you know, it has its advantages. And each country will choose on its own. What happens in the really long run, one doesn't know, because there is a theory that beyond a certain point, autocracies will become democracies if you get to a GDP of $11,000 per. I mean, there are people with theories of how this will inevitably happen. For the time being, every single Asian and other country, I think, is just going to follow its own path. It's not going to be either trying to copy India or China. They will try to extract a little from those things, but basically they are going to have their own models.
I would say that in the next decade, India will continue to do well and close the gap between China and India. And that will provide some comfort for those who would like to see democracy perform better in developing countries. Second is that we really have not looked at the costs of the Chinese model, because China's success is easy to see. Measure GDP, measure exports, look at the hard infrastructure. But you've got to look at the other side of the ledger, that is environmental degradation, human rights violations, suffering. Because I would say, if I have to pick two countries to live in with absolutely the same standard of living, I'll pick a country where I can vote, because that's worth something. So that's, I think, if you do a more sophisticated accounting of China's achievement, you would downgrade China's score by at least, I would say, 20%, 25%. So that closes the gap. And certainly, that at the current rate of growth, China will run into this big problem of how to deal with a society that is more wealthy, more informed, more diverse, and more demanding. Today, China's urbanization is around 45, 50%. It will be very hard for the current one-party system to remain in place if urbanization reaches 25%, because it's extremely difficult to prevent organized urban groups to challenge government policy. So I would say that the current one-party state is doomed no matter what. If it's successful, then it deals with the problem of success of modernization. But it's unsuccessful, then the Chinese model will be rejected by its own people.
Kevin, do you want to comment? I have one other question. I'll move to some questions from the audience in just a moment. I mentioned earlier the most impressive aspect of China to me was a lot of these people with bicultural experience. The most distressing aspect of modern China, I think, to most people there is the environmental disaster of the large cities in particular and the industrial zones. Is there anything intrinsic to the Asian model that is part of this? This is just China's scale situation. Should we think of this? How should we think of this as being part of the Asian model or not?
Okay, there is an Asian model of pollution, if you like. There is a large brown haze over large parts of, so in fact, this might be actually our solution to global warming. We will produce so much pollution that the sun, that the warming cannot take. So this is a generalized phenomenon.
He says there's no good news.
We'll suffocate first before we get
dry. Yeah. The problem will be bronchitis rather than all the other ailments. And this is, if you take a large number of cities in India, they are almost as bad as many cities in China. But as industrialization and urbanization proceeds, as you have a large number of poor people coming in, a reluctance to spend on diminishing pollution. They say, everybody says, look at England, look at America. They got to that income level and only then they started focusing. Let us go the same path. The difference is the size of the populations and the size of your urban things is unprecedented. So as far as I can see, this is a tough nut to crack. Democracy and active civil society is a great help. I would contrast the marble in the Forbidden City with the marble in the Taj Mahal. In the early 1970s, civic groups suddenly said, hey, this white marble is, I can see a tinge of gray, only a tinge, not easy to see. But, a huge hoo-ha, and they said we have to move all the industries out of place, steam locos must be converted to all kinds of things. And they even now developed something they call a mud pack. Because they say, if we clean off the pollution, we are abrading the surface. So now they've got they devised a clay mud pack, and you put it on, and it apparently absorbs the black deposits without, you know. So there is this huge emphasis because of democratic action. Whereas, I mean, in the Forbidden City, once upon a time, that marble was beautiful white. Today is serious gray with all kinds of other plots. I mean, I saw it first 25 years ago. It was beautiful. It's really gone downhill. And there is no movement in China like there was on the Taj Mahal. So I would say, you know, the democracy part of it, in my view, is a very important aspect to try and check this. We have a huge number of NGOs. So this gives some hope. I mean, there's this government apathy of, you know, what's the hurry? Let's get ahead with other things. But a very active civil society in India has been important. China, I think, will need to develop that too to reduce pollution there.
Comments from either of you?
Just a quick word. I think the Asians suffer from what I call selective negative learning from the Western experience. They always point to awful things the West has done in its history and try to use that to justify the awful things they are doing to themselves today.
and I certainly don't want to get into celebrating totalitarian systems, but Beijing's response to the air pollution problem in the run-up to the Olympics. And let's be clear, the Olympics is, along with the 17th Party Congress, the organizing principle, right? The moment in Chinese behavior. In order to dial back on pollution 2 days ago, it was declared that 1 million cars currently driving the streets of Beijing will no longer drive. One third of all automobiles in Beijing will not be on the streets. Full stop, thank you very much. And I can promise you they can enforce that.
Look, that's only a dry run, because for two weeks, and I will be there in Beijing, so I will extra benefit. They will do a test to see how much that will actually improve air quality and traffic.
So to Tom Friedman's point of last night, political will is important, but I would say having it be sustainable, durable, and popularly accepted is not trivial either.
I'm going to ask one more question. While I'm asking this and the panelists are answering, please go to the microphones at either side of the room. I'm going to preface this question with my analogy to your tale of the Taj Mahal and the Forbidden City. You were talking about how the delicate marble of the Taj Mahal and the Forbidden City was hurt by the air of East Asia. I interviewed an engineer from General Electric's airplane motor division who was sent to China to find out why their titanium turbine blades could not last in the Chinese airline fleet. So the titanium is not just marble, but titanium is being corroded by the air around Beijing. Here is my question, for which I'd like to lead with Kevin. We have examples in history of shifts in world power being accommodated well and poorly. Classic examples are England accommodated the rise of U.S. in a more or less proper fashion. The world did not accommodate the rise of Germany in a very good fashion, nor the rise of Japan. What can the United States, as the dominant power of now, what should it be doing to accommodate the rise, however far it goes, of India and China?
Your view of history's management of emerging great powers is a generous one. I use as a throwaway line the fact that it's been very consistent. It has absolutely failed almost all the time. Occasionally, we sort of kind of get it right, as with the Brits. But it takes a generous spirit that isn't much in evidence. I think the answer is habits of cooperation. If you start to make it essential to talk to China and India, and this has to be a rich, sustained dialogue about, be it pollution, health issues, with Tony Fauci, who's going to discuss this afternoon, all of these things that are shared problems and for which there are nothing but shared solutions. And if you look at the foreign policy examples of late on North Korea and on Iran increasingly, if the U.S. and China, or the U.S., China, and India express a shared political will on something in the foreign policy sphere, I bet it's going to get done. So, Jim, I'd say habits of cooperation and just keeping a much deeper dialogue than we're used to doing. By the way, that's hard to do. You know, Bodman went over, Secretary of Energy, went over to have the first strategic dialogue on energy, and the poor guy discovered he has no Chinese counterpart. There is no Secretary of Energy in China. So even asymmetries in the system are going to frustrate this, but I think it's a high goal.
And how about from either of your perspectives?
Okay, from the Indian perspective, India's economic weight, I would say, is way, way above its political weight. The fact is that we had this idea that, you know, we may be a poor country, but we will dominate South Asia. The result was everybody in South Asia hates us. We are actually unable to dominate. The moment India wants anything, everybody will say, well, this is a terrible idea. So it is not true that India has large political strength. In fact, you will find in America for a very long time, India and tiny Pakistan were equated constantly. Right? I mean, in economic terms, there's no comparison. Yet in the political terms, there was much more comparison of the two. So India at best wants to have some kind of regional thing. It does not have any great fancy ideas on what is to be done on a much larger field. It wants to focus, I think, first of all, internally. I mean, we have supposedly Maoist insurgencies in 150 districts in India, Maoists from Nepalese, Al-Qaeda guys coming to Kashmir. I mean, as I said, before you conquer foreign dominions, what about conquering your internal districts and getting them? I mean, that is a huge focus. Getting better relationships with your own neighbors is an extremely important and extremely difficult task. Mm. There is much less of a global ambition.
I'll say two things. First, I think the U.S. has done a relatively good job in accommodating China's rise, despite all kinds of differences and long-term problems. Second is that I do not believe that China's rise will pose a real challenge to American supremacy. There's one thing very simple. If you want to dominate the world, you not only need the hard power, the strength, military, economic, you really need a vision, an alternative vision of how the world ought to be governed, ought to run. China today has a bankruptcy of ideas. You ask Chinese leaders what they think about the world. I mean, what kind of values should prevail? I think you're going to stump them. So as long as the Chinese leader, the Chinese political system, cannot generate an alternative political vision of the world. The Soviet Union had a political vision of the communism. China today does not have that. So I'm actually very, very comfortable on the basis of this ideological, spiritual bankruptcy that China at some point will run into a dead end in its rise to global prominence.
Let me just follow up on that one point before taking your question, which is that if you asked at least the foreign ministry spokesman that question, they say, oh, our vision is of the harmonious world order with harmonious societies. And so at least that's an answer, right?
Then you pursue further, what do you mean by harmonious society, harmonious world
order? The answer ultimately is nobody is here but us peace-loving Chinese, which even they don't believe, right?
And that no country interferes with the internal affairs of another. Yes, would you please identify yourself and ask a question?
Sure. Mike Morgan, and the question is, a number of recent articles, the journal just last week, I think, on the rapid rise of wages for skilled, in this case, skilled Indian labor, and how jobs are now coming back to Silicon Valley and the Bay Area. Just curious for, has the pace of wage increases in each of the countries been surprising to you? Where do you think the pace of change is going in the future? And how is that going to play out both in internal domestic politics as well as sort of the U.S. impact on globalization in general? Just curious for your perspective.
Well, you know, the whole point of globalization is supposed to be that it benefits. There is something called a factor price equalization theorem in economics, that if you have proper globalization, wages should begin to equalize. So, I mean, that's both good and bad news. It means some poor people in India get much richer. It means some Americans can feel, we are no longer under threat from these very low-wage fellows. The rise in wages is going to be far more strident in the high-skill areas. So wherever it comes to the skill, I mean, in India, I mean, there was this recent news item of a company that moved back from India to the United States because Indian wages had risen too fast. However, in the case of manufacturing, there's a reserve army of rural labor which is still available. So the wage levels, I think, will rise much faster in the skilled and service areas. India has a huge shortage of engineers. I think it'll happen in China. But for the guys who are not at a tertiary level of education, I think it will be much less. But at the end of it all, I am personally convinced that this is a manageable issue. The size of the pie is rising extraordinarily fast. It's no longer just, America dominates the world economy with everybody else rising. When the global pie is rising so fast, even if there is some erosion of American dominance, so what? It will still remain an extremely rich and extremely prosperous country and probably number one for decades to come. So if there are more people at the high table, I don't think that should be a problem.
In the case of China, the problem is not with manufacturing, average manufacturing cost, but with so-called churning. The managerial talent is very difficult to come by. Again, at the high end, there's a lot of churning among managers at the senior level, and that's a big headache for foreign companies who operate in China.
Just to add one point there, a quote I had in my current article from Dominic Barton of McKinsey's China practice, he said, if you look around the world's organizations are full of Indian managers, and there's very few Chinese managers, and so this is a problem for the Chinese internally and also in their globalization. Yes, next question, please.
Ellen Gibbs, I just question, you're talking about the peaceful harmony in China. How does that relate to Taiwan? And where do you see the outcome in Hong Kong as well?
In Hong Kong was the last thing you said, yes. So Taiwan and Hong Kong.
No, the Chinese are very careful when they say, when we talk about Taiwan, it's internal. So somehow it does not qualify for the benefits of this harmonious world. And then they'll dance around the issue of Taiwan, say we have a policy of peaceful reunification, but we reserve the right to use force. If you are asking about China's current policy toward Taiwan, I would say it's much more focused on using economic, diplomatic means to attract Taiwan and to isolate Taiwan. It has placed much less emphasis on military means because, frankly, military intimidation has backfired in the past and has proved to be extremely unattractive to the average people in Taiwan.
From a risk analysis perspective, you know there's elections in Taiwan in 08. Watch that space. I think in the run-up, there's going to be a lot of rather exciting talk. I what Minchin says about the Chinese, understand that about 2 years ago the choice was made that in fact time is on Beijing's side with respect to Taiwan. And if you look at what is acceptable in the political vocabulary on Taiwan and what's acceptable in Beijing in terms of loose affiliation about Hong Kong model, but keep your own army, all this kind of stuff. A People's Republic of China where you change the name, or a country of China, or a customs union of China where you change the flag, change the name, change the capital. These are all suggestions that have been out there. Beijing's patient, there's less political patience in Taiwan. And the thing I find remarkable is I would have bet you that this administration would have mismanaged the Taiwan issue. And to the contrary, they have done an artful job of not letting the U.S. be played by either side.
And Hong Kong?
I have a question about Hong Kong, which I'll ask you to answer, Kevin, and also this. My impression is that the U.S. and the Chinese government have a symmetrical interest in not coming to a showdown over Taiwan.
I think it's absolutely right.
And Hong Kong, briefly, it's going okay, right?
Just had the 10-year anniversary. The PLA got new uniforms. It's all good, except... talking to a friend who was there last week, and you can comment on this, it's becoming more another Chinese city.
Chinese city.
Unless you live in a Chinese city, it seems like paradise when you go there for
yes.
a Chinese
yes.
city.
You bet.
And by the way, the whole notion of can you have Shanghai as an economic capital and Hong Kong as a capital? Look at the size of the economy, for crying out loud. They got $1.2 trillion. I'd say, yeah, maybe three or four others, too. I mean, why not?
So next question, please.
Yeah, hi, Dan Glickman. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Olympics. And it was raised just quickly, Kevin, I think you did, maybe others did before I came in. But, it seems that over the next year, the Chinese will be doing things with cars and maybe getting pirated DVDs off the streets, which is, of course, interest to me and other things. But I'm wondering if there's anything more profound about the Olympics and what the United States and Europe, the rest of the world, can be doing over the next year to get China to make some more fundamental infrastructure institutional changes that might outlast next summer.
No, I don't think the Olympics will have a long-term impact on how the Chinese political system works. It will have a long-term impact on Beijing's infrastructure. So post-Olympics, Beijing's nightmarish traffic jam will be greatly reduced. That's good news for the people in Beijing. Because the Olympic game in the Chinese political calculation serves only one goal, that is to legitimize the Chinese Communist Party. The Chinese Communist Party wants to show to its own people that it has international respect. And that's the end of the story. And regrettably or not, The Chinese people actually have bought into this story. The Chinese people love to have a good game because they believe that it's time, it's China's time to enjoy the day under the sun. So that's the problem. So because of the confluence of these two types of thinking, it's very hard to leverage the Olympic Games as an opportunity for long-term political change.
Mr. Secretary, I think that's right. I would hope that this, the amount of pride that's been freighted on the Games, though, does allow people, to my somewhat fuzzy point before about habits of cooperation, to force the leadership to talk about some of these issues in a way that's different and better. I was living in Beijing during the Asian Games, the last big thing, sports event in Beijing. And you know, it profoundly mattered to ordinary people, my students, others, that China be perceived as a world-class place. So, no, does it change the terms of debate, but does it provide an opportunity to sort of patiently work issues? Yeah, I think it does. I think it does.
If I could add just a couple quick points about this. One on the DVD front, which I know is of intense interest to you. It's been amusing to me in Shanghai to see the outrage stories in the paper about pirated Olympic material, when I know that the stores all around there are, you know, the cops are standing in front of them. They're selling every DVD for 60 cents, which is interesting. Second, about the permanence of the Olympic changes. There, right now, there's a law affecting foreign reporters like me. From January 1st of this year, there are a whole lot more liberties for foreign reporters. That law expires 2 weeks after the closing ceremonies of the Olympic Games. And I guess the third thing about the Olympics is I think it's very important that these be seen as a success for China, because there's so much emphasis on it that if they're a failure, quote-unquote, if people don't like China, if their athletes don't win, I think that's going to be ugly for all around.
But, Jim, isn't it going to be a very mixed picture? I mean, you're in the media business. I mean, you guys aren't going to take the gloves off.
When somebody gets spit on by a passerby or gets run over by a rogue bus, you know, there might be unflattering publicity. Yeah. Yes?
Tom Korologos, don't forget at the Olympics there are going to be about 30,000, 40,000 reporters wandering around China. They ain't just going to sit there between Beijing and Shanghai. They're going to start going to Western China, and you're going to see a lot more stories, a lot more what's going on politically on the Western areas. Touch on the politics of that, what's happening in those areas and how that's going to affect this China rise. Don't forget they still jam the Radio Free Asia, they jam Voice of America. Things ain't going so hot in Tibet. There's some political activity going on that I'd like to hear a little bit about.
Yeah, if those reporters go to the hinterlands of China, as long as what they write about what I call routine poverty, routine poor governance, it's okay. If for some reason it so happens that when they are in a particular village or particular city, there's massive uprising, riots, I mean, that's really bad news. But I do not expect that to happen, because the Chinese government has a very effective secret police, extensive network of informers, and the people actually will be working for the government just to make sure that for a month, next August, China actually experiences the most peaceful month in recent memory. So,
and importantly, you said before, the national ethos, personal pride, even to the guy who's making $200 a year on the potato farm in outside of Heilongjiang, you know, they actually care. So they're in on the joke. But Tom, I think you're right to what Jim said before. There are going to be some really bad stories, aren't there, of necessity. And can the Chinese live with that? Yeah, they'll have to. But if it doesn't touch on essential security issues, I think Minchin's right. It'll fall into two boxes.
Yeah, I think that the real problem is China's so-called enemies abroad, like Falun Gong, like pro-dependent people, pro-Taiwan independence people, they will infiltrate as tourists, as spectators. They'll congregate in Beijing, stage an event on Tiananmen Square. Then what does the Chinese secret police do? I mean, roughen them up in front of CNN? I mean, that's the nightmare for the Chinese government. They're not worried about workers staging a huge strike, because Chinese workers are smart enough not to do this, even if they may be really angry with their government.
I think we have time for one more questioner who is here.
Yeah, this is Vinod Sopti. My question is actually in two parts. First is that there has been a lot of judicial and NGO activism, which has been seen in India, as pointed out by the speaker. Now, is that activism sustainable and it's good for the system? And how does that play in China, whether they have anything like this, this model being coming up in the near future?
So NGOs and civil society in India and China.
Okay, I mean, this is India's strength. The truth is that the government itself in India, while in some sense being enormously powerful, is terribly weak in the terms of its actual organs. So the judiciary in some sense has finally lost patience and has started to give executive orders on a very wide number of things, including laying down detailed specifications for the amount of different kinds of Euro emission norms for automobiles. I mean, this is not what a court should be doing, but therefore, seeing that the government doesn't seem to function, seeing that there are too many pushes and pulls, we now have an extraordinarily activist judiciary getting into the executive field in a very large way. By and large, there's public applause. There are obviously some excesses. There are some people will be troubled that, you know, institutionally the model is going haywire. Right? This is not how it's actually supposed to go. All I can say is that the checks and balances in the system are such that when politicians had legitimacy immediately after the independence movement, no judge would have dared intrude into the legislative field. But now the moment you see that the moral authority has changed with the different institutions, institutions are able to occupy that space and it is for the public good. The NGO and activism is a big story. And it's a big story in more than just, I mean, originally they were activists wanting the government to do A and B. Then it grew into activists who are NGOs that are actually delivering services. So the government, through its banking system, attempted to deliver credit to the poor and failed. The microcredit societies, which are now coming up, I mean, last count was 10 million, rising to 20 million. Disclosure, I myself have co-promoted 3 microfinance institutions. So these are now getting things out. Plus this micro-franchising taking place. So this activist NGO thing is extraordinarily important. It is filling a number of gaps in the relatively weak government system and within the contradictions that you get on the political side in any democracy. In the case of China, I can see that an authoritarian government would not be able to accommodate this. I would be very interested in knowing whether these guys can proceed independent of the government, and if so, how?
I would say in China, the government genuinely views NGOs as a threat. But there are small exceptions. Environment, public health, they will allow a small number of groups to operate. But they monitor them very, very carefully. If you look at the aggregate numbers, the NGO development in China is way, way behind what it ought to be. I once did a comparison. Early 90s, China's NGOs were weaker, both in terms of types, funding, variety, than Taiwan in the early 60s. So 30 years behind Taiwan. And recently I saw another study. In the 20s, China had more NGOs than China has today. So it's really a one-party authoritarian state. It has learned one thing from the Soviet collapse, that is, you should never allow oppositions to have any form of organization. Because today, the NGOs can be pushing for environmental protection, public health. Tomorrow, they could be pushing for the downfall of the Communist Party.
So by my watch, we have 2 minutes left here. I'd like to ask each of our panelists for one sentence in reply. Here's the question. What's the main thing you think Americans should know about respectively India, China, and America's interest in India and China that they don't? What's the main thing that Americans don't understand about India?
The main thing is that we are aimed for co-prosperity. Don't look upon India and China as threats.
Well, I would say the main thing is that China's success should be no cause of fear for Americans. China's failure should be the real cause of fear.
Kevin, our interest.
Don't expect their governments to be any better than ours at crisis management, confidence building, or expressing their interest overseas.
Great. With that, please join me in thanking these excellent panelists.